KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. About 50 years ago, a diverse group of characters began to capture children's hearts. Spider-Man, Captain America, The Incredible Hulk, Iron Man, the X-Men, to name a few. The epic Marvel Comics universe has been a massive force in pop culture, inspiring countless books, films, and becoming a multi-billion dollar enterprise. Sean Howe chronicles the rise of this phenomenon in Marvel Comics, The Untold Story. Howe spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on October 17th, 2012.
Hi, guys. So just to get a little bit of a sense, how many of you would consider yourselves comic book readers? Okay.
Was.
Okay, great. So for some of you, I'm gonna talk just a little bit about what you know my take on Marvel Comics is, and hopefully those of you who already have a really good sense of it will not feel like it's a remedial class. So Marvel Comics is arguably it's the most intricate fictional narrative in the history of the world, which is a pretty big claim to make, I know. But if you think about a company that's been telling stories every month, several stories a month, for 70 years, it probably leaves the guiding light and all my children, and as the world turns in the dust. It's sort of like if you had if you had The Wire and Mad Men and Breaking Bad and combined them all, and then each character had a spin-off series, and then that ran for several decades, then you know you'd get a little bit of a sense of just how complicated the Marvel world is. And so that's an amazing tradition. It's the modern mythology. And it is something that kids are exposed to at an early age, and it shapes their moral systems and shapes their vocabularies. And I think that what makes Marvel Comics particularly interesting to me is that this grand narrative is handed down from generation to generation. There are creators, there's artists and writers who take a crack at this story, this overarching tapestry of fiction, and then inevitably they have to give it up. They have to pass it on. It's like the exquisite corpse game of the French surrealists, where they are not in control of what the final product is, and so the American mythology of the 21st century is also a group of trademarks. You know, it's intellectual property. It's part of our heritage, but we don't own it. And so that makes for a lot of interesting collisions of art and commerce. So the company was started in the late 1930s after Superman was a huge hit. There was a guy named Martin Goodman who was a publisher of pulp magazines, and he approached a comic book packager because after Superman broke a lot of sales records, there were all these companies that would put together the art and writing of the comic books and sell them off to whoever the highest bidder was. And so that is how the Human Torch and the Submariner came to be. They were sort of farmed out work, companies called Funnies Incorporated. And the Human Torch was by a 20-year-old kid named Carl Burgos, and the Submariner was by a 21-year-old kid named Bill Everett. And then Martin Goodman got tired of paying someone else to do this, paying the middleman. And so he thought it would be great if I could just get some guys to do this for me. So he got a couple artists named Joe Simon and Jack Kirby. They created Captain America, which was a huge hit in 1940. And shortly after that, Martin Goodman's wife's cousin was a teenager. His name was Stanley Lieber. And he came along and he became sort of the office boy. And he emptied out ashtrays. And he got sandwiches for the artists. And he picked up, you know, when you use an eraser, all the pink junk that gets left behind, he swept that up. And when Jack Kirby and Joe Simon decided that they weren't getting a good enough deal from Martin Goodman, Stanley went into the void of power, and he became the editor of Marvel Comics, or it was called Timely Comics at the time. Stanley enjoyed 15 years of very comfortable editorship of Timely Comics. In the 1950s, there was a Senate subcommittee hearing about the dangers of comic books and their contribution to juvenile delinquency. And there were church-sponsored burnings of comic books. And there was a book by a child psychologist named Frederick Wortham, and it just described in detail the lurid business of these horror comics, and the bottom fell out of the industry. It was decimated. Marvel kept it together for a few years, and unfortunately in 1957 they signed a distribution deal with a company that was just about to go out of business itself. Stan Lee had seen Timely Comics grow, and he had like three secretaries that he would dictate to all at once. He enjoyed the power trip. He had to fire everyone. So pretty soon, you know, Martin Goodman's company, still a magazine publisher, and Stan Lee, as he became known, not Stan Lieber, he was in a cubicle and shoved into the corner of the magazine offices. And he was working with a series of freelancers and just putting out kind of like monster movie comic books. So there would be like Groot, which was an alien tree that sort of terrorized citizens. It was not really like amazing stuff. In the early 60s, Stan Lee, still working from a cubicle, you know, sort of shoved to the side and disrespected by all the magazine editors, he was charged with starting up some more superheroes. Superheroes had fallen out of vogue for a few years. Jack Kirby, who had left in 1941, had also suffered the terrible fortunes of the comic book industry. Jack Kirby returned to Marvel, and together, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby brought out the Avengers, and where the Avengers were Iron Man and Thor and the Hulk and the X-Men and with Steve Ditko, who is another freelancer, Spider-Man came out. So in the course of like 3 years, you had Hulk and Iron Man and the return of Captain America and Spider-Man and Daredevil and all of these characters that are now big Hollywood property. And they started hiring more people again. Now they rebranded themselves as Marvel Comics, and that's the part that I'm going to pick up with. I'm going to read a little bit. By now, Marvel's newsprint masterpieces were being referenced in Cornell physics classes and Colgate student newspapers, and Lee was fielding regular requests for campus speaking. Newspapers, slowly at first, sat up and took notice. The Wall Street Journal noted the sales increases, while the Village Voice pointed out Beatnik's embrace of the kooky, hip stories. Marvel Comics are the first comic books in history in which a post-adolescent escapist can get involved, the voice gushed. For Marvel Comics are the first comic books to evoke, even metaphorically, the real world. Lee's snappy, self-conscious patter was singled out, as was the verisimilitude of the New York City settings. There are approximately 15 superheroes in the Marvel group, and nearly all of them live in the New York area. Midtown Manhattan is full of their landmarks. On Madison Avenue, the Baxter Building houses the Fantastic Four and their various self-protective devices. Doctor Strange is a master of occult knowledge and often walks around in ectoplasmic form. His creators imply that he lives in the Village because no one there is likely to become alarmed at being jostled by a wraith. Meanwhile, in San Francisco, poet Michael McClure featured a Doctor Strange monologue from Strange Tales number 130 as a centerpiece to his controversial 1965 play, The Beard. A similar infatuation gripped the art world. Roy Lichtenstein appropriated one of Kirby's X-Men panels for his painting Image Duplicator, and future Warhol collaborator Paul Morrissey made a 10-minute experimental film, The Origin of Captain America, in which an actor read from Tales of Suspense number 63. There were scattered other comics in the background of Morrissey's film, and all of them were from Marvel. Lee seized the opportunity and slapped a Marvel Pop Art Productions logo on the corners of the covers. Kirby found resonances with modern art as well. He experimented with photo collages in his Fantastic Four stories, lending grandiosity to outer space and interdimensional sequences. The comics also caught the attention of Robert Lawrence, a partner in Grant Ray Lawrence Animation, who spied them on newsstands and made the connection to the pop art movement. He contacted Martin Goodman, who by now was teaching his younger son, Chip, the ins and outs of the family business. Grant Ray Lawrence made a sweetheart deal to produce an animated series, The Marvel Superheroes, taking all its images directly from published comic panels. The studio secured a continuing interest in merchandising profits related to the show. "We wrote an unbelievable contract with the Goodmans," Lawrence boasted, "because they didn't know what they had and where to go." None of this impressed the guys at magazine management, who couldn't understand all the sudden attention being paid to so much kid stuff. When Marvel fan Federico Fellini, in New York to promote Juliet of the Spirits, swept into 625 Madison Avenue to meet Stan Lee, Men magazine editor Mel Shestack scoffed that Lee didn't even know who Fellini was. Years later, Shestack insisted that the director had quickly lost interest in Lee and cottoned instead to the more colorful magazine editors, who were themselves like, quote, living comic books. Such condescension was the norm. "They were always making jokes about us. They'd come in and giggle," remembered Flo Steinberg, the Marvel secretary. Mario Puzo would look in and would see us all working on his way to the office, and he would say, "Work faster, little elves. Christmas is coming." In truth, the magazines were still Martin Goodman's bread and butter. "It wasn't the comic books," said Ivan Prashker, another editor. "The guys who worked at the men's magazines all thought Stan Lee was a schmuck." In the fall of 1965, assistant editor Roy Thomas recruited fellow Missourian Dennis O'Neill to work as Marvel's second editorial assistant. Within a matter of weeks, one of the magazine editors tried to enlist O'Neill in a scheme to dose Stan Lee with LSD. "He was going to supply a sugar cube of acid," said O'Neill later. "My mission, should I have chosen to accept it, would have been to drop it into his coffee." O'Neill, a self-described hippie liberal rebel who had been lectured by Lee for wearing a t-shirt depicting a cannabis plant to the office, nonetheless declined. At the end of 1965, when a reporter named Nat Friedland visited the Marvel offices for a 3,000-word profile for the New York Herald Tribune, he found Lee in an unusually candid mood. "I don't plot Spider-Man anymore," he said. "Steve Ditko, the artist, has been doing the stories. I guess I'll leave him alone until sales start to slip. Since Spidey got so popular, Ditko thinks he's the genius of the world. We were arguing so much over plot lines, I told him to start making up his own stories. He won't let anybody else ink his drawings either. He just drops off the finished pages with notes at the margins, and I fill in the dialogue. I never know what he'll come up with next, but it's interesting to work that way." Friedland was impressed with Lee. He painted him as an Ultra Madison Avenue rangy lookalike of Rex Harrison, responsible for tripling the comic's circulation to 35 million copies a year, selling 40,000 memberships to the Mary Marvel Marching Society, and inspiring 500 fan letters a day. Friedland depicted Lee wearing out his eyes from reading mail and fretting over the choice of exactly the right sound effect for a page of Fantastic Four number 59. Charmed by Lee's self-deprecating quips and Fellini anecdotes, the reporter barely made mention of Martin Goodman and skimmed over Ditko's contributions, referring to Spider-Man as Lee's masterpiece, the most offbeat character he could think of. Friedland arranged to sit in on one of Lee and Kirby's Friday morning pitching sessions, and his timing couldn't have been better. They were hashing out the Fantastic Four, which was approaching a firing on all cylinders peak, tying together the subplots they'd been weaving for months. "The Thing finally beats the Silver Surfer," Lee pitched to Kirby as Friedland jotted notes. But then Alicia makes him realize he's made a terrible mistake. This is what the Thing has always feared more than anything else, that he would lose control and really clobber somebody. The effusive Lee gained momentum as he went forward, with Kirby simply interjecting with nods and rights. The thing is broken-hearted. He wanders off by himself. He's too ashamed to face Alicia or go back home to the Fantastic Four. He doesn't realize how he's failing for the second time, how much the FF needs him. Friedland cut to Kirby, a, quote, middle-aged man with baggy eyes and a baggy Robert Hall-ish suit. He is sucking a huge green cigar, and if you stood next to him on the subway, you would peg him for the assistant foreman in a girdle factory. "Great," Friedland quoted Kirby as saying in a high-pitched voice. "Great." Many months later, when an account of the Thing's fight with the Silver Surfer finally emerged, Kirby had changed it and expanded it significantly. It appeared as the coda to a grand space opera, a brew of existentialism and high adventure, for which he had done the heavy lifting. Despite his perpetual freelancer status, Kirby not only generated plots with Lee, but was also the primary force when it came to designing characters and pacing stories. By now he was, in a sense, the director of the films they made together, composing each shot and driving the narrative with momentum of his images. "I don't see him for a week," Lee told one interviewer. "He comes back a week later and the whole strip is drawn, and nobody knows what I'm going to see on those pages. He may have come up with a dozen new ideas, you see, and then I take it and I write it on the basis of what Jack has drawn. He's broken it down to continuity for me. He's drawn the whole thing, actually. I put in the dialogue and the captions, so he doesn't exactly know what I'm going to write, what words I'm going to put into their mouths. I don't know what he's going to draw." In fact, the Silver Surfer, who had yet to debut at the time of Friedland's article, was wholly Kirby's creation, and had been a surprise to Lee when the completed pages arrived. Occasionally, when Kirby came into the office, he and artist John Romita would catch a ride home to Long Island with Lee. Romita would crawl into the back of Lee's Cadillac and listen while Lee and Kirby discussed plots. As the convertible dodged in and out of Queens Boulevard traffic, they would volley ideas, each oblivious to the other. "It's almost like I was watching Laurel and Hardy," Romita said. "These two guys are in the front, two giants, and Jack is saying, 'Well, Stanley, what are we going to make the kid like? Is he going to be a wizard? Is he going to be a genius? Is he going to be superpowered? Or is he going to be a normal kid in the midst of a crazy family?' Stan would say, 'Well, let's try this and let's try that.' So Stan would go off on a tangent and Jack would be talking about what he thought should happen. And then Jack would go home and do what he thought Stan was expecting. And when Stan got the script, I could hear him say, 'Jack forgot what we were talking about.'" Early in the morning of January 9th, 1966, Stanley got a phone call from Roz Kirby, Jack's wife. The Herald Tribune story was out. "She was almost hysterical," Lee said, "and she shouted, 'How could you do this? How could you have done this to Jack?'" When Lee finally got his hands on the article, he said later, he could understand her outrage. She had every right to be upset. "About four-fifths of the article was about me, and made me out to be the most glamorous, wonderful human being that ever lived, and the very last few paragraphs were about Jack and made him sound like a jerk." Lee pleaded his innocence to the Kirbys. Before long, the credits on Fantastic Four and Thor regularly read, "A Stan Lee and Jack Kirby production." There would be no more "written by Stan Lee" on the Kirby books. Tempers cooled, but Kirby would remember the slight for the rest of his life.
Sean Howe, the author of Marvel Comics' The Untold Story. Howe spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on October 17th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Sean Howe in a moment. 925, 94.9 KUOW. Before last week, if you were a high school senior applying to George Washington University, you would have seen a line on their admissions page that read, "Requests for financial aid do not affect admissions decisions." That's on their admissions webpage. Log on today and that line is not there anymore. George Washington University was, in fact, not needs blind, and it was and is needs aware. May not sound like much, but the difference is big. We're going to talk about how income is influencing college admissions with Scott Jasek, a founder and editor at Inside Higher Ed. That'll be tomorrow afternoon at 1. Forecast says lows in the 40s tonight for the Seattle area. Mostly cloudy, chance of showers. Friday highs mid to upper 50s, mostly cloudy, chance of rain. Support for KUOW comes from Whatcom Museum's Lightcatcher Galleries in Bellingham, showcasing the beauty of Earth's frozen frontiers through 90 works of art from 12 countries. The Vanishing Ice exhibit frames this body of art within the context of climate change. On view starting November 3rd. Details at whatcommuseum.org. Support for KUOW comes from Forest Ridge School of the Sacred Heart, a private Catholic school for girls grades 5 through 12 in Bellevue, offering an IB curriculum and a boarding program. Open house on Saturday, November 2nd. Details at forestridge.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. What can we learn from comic books? Sean Howe is the author of Marvel Comics' The Untold Story. The book chronicles how comics became a massive force in pop culture. Howe spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on October 17, 2012. Next, he takes questions from the audience. The first question is about how comic books don't have the dangerous reputation they once did.
You know, comic books in 1954 were sort of at the forefront of teen rebellion culture. There was no Elvis Presley. James Dean wasn't really a pinup yet. It was comic books that were the culture that kids would sort of smuggle in from the bigger outdoor world. And so I think that is one of the major reasons that they were such an easy scapegoat. They were also kind of crazy at that time. The horror comics that were at the center of the controversies, some of them had things like there was a baseball team of felons of ex, maybe they were actually prisoners, and they were playing with the balls and bats were made from like entrails and bones of fellow prisoners, and so I understand why parents might think that this wasn't so cool for like 8-year-old Johnny to be bringing home every month. What came out of this scare was the comic publishers got together and created something called the Comics Magazine Association of America, an industry group that then put out something called the Comics Code, which was kind of like the Hays Code of Hollywood. And you didn't see much that would be controversial for a long time after that. They really kind of took the teeth out of comic books. For a long time, you couldn't use the word werewolf in a comic book. Like, that was just pushing things too far. And Stan Lee never really shook his fears that the comic industry was going to be taken down by something like that again. And I think that really contributed to his reluctance at times to tackle any issues that might divide his audience. Hi.
Hi. I'm not sure if this is grounded in fact. Maybe you can correct me. But I remember either reading or hearing that some of the earliest superheroes were shaped to boost U.S. morale during World War II. Is that correct, or maybe it was a different war?
Yeah, it's possible that some of those early World War II era characters were propaganda tools, or I guess more gently, morale boosters.
Because when was Superman?
Superman was first published in 1938, and Superman was really kind of just this populist New Deal hero, and he fought civic corruption mostly, and he certainly did take on more of a patriotic role as the years went on, but I would probably chalk up Captain America, for instance, to you know, Jack Kirby being a Jewish kid from the Lower East Side who had his chance to, you know, draw. The first issue of Captain America is Captain America punching Hitler, and that was a year before Pearl Harbor. So I think that, you know, the patriotic angle of those characters is probably more organic and coming, you know, directly from the hearts and minds of the artists.
Yes. Were there artists who tried to put more of an explicitly left-wing angle into their comics? And if so, were they cracked down on during the McCarthy period?
I'm not sure how much left-wing politics seeped into the 1950s comics, especially at Marvel. I think there was a lot of just straight genre stuff, and at EC Comics, which was the publisher of a lot of those lurid horror tales, there certainly was. There were comics that had a response to the witch hunts of McCarthyism, and some have argued that that was part of what put the target on their backs. Timely / Marvel Comics was always a little bit less daring than that. When you move into the 1960s, Stan Lee starts getting letters from, he'll get a letter from a young fan who's also a member of like the SDS, who wants to know why there's not a better depiction of like Vietnam War protesters, and then someone else wants to know why Captain America isn't going to fight in Vietnam, and you can see Stan Lee starting to freak out a little bit in these letter columns. You know, he so wants to just waffle on these issues. He's very much like a politician. And he wants to just stay out of it and not rock the boat. And then what you have in the early 1970s is Stan Lee starts to move away from the hands-on editing, and some younger guys start to take over a little bit more, is you have the counterculture voices of the younger generation starting to come through. And this is a lot like, you know, the new Hollywood. This is sort of the equivalent of Coppola and Scorsese. You've got stories where the superhero comics are being written by guys who are dropping acid and walking around in the Manhattan streets and acting out what all the action scenes are going to be. And some of the stories are about the meaning of God. And then there's, you know, adventures that take place at like head shops. And that's something that really happened after Stan Lee's watch. And there was a, sort of a brief moment where progressive politics definitely played a big part in Marvel. But it took a while. Yeah. Hi.
I think a lot of comic books, they try to parallel real life. There was a comment about World War II. You know, Captain America going against the Red Skull and the Nazis, you know, in issue after issue after issue. And then later in the 60s, they had the civil rights. You had, for the first time, you had black comic book characters, Black Panther, you had Green Lantern and Green Arrow trying to get civil rights for the blacks.
Right.
And then that phase kind of went, once society went beyond that, then comic books evolved into something else.
Right, right. The Marvel's reaction to the civil rights movement and the feminist movement was both delayed and a little bit clumsy. In fact, Jack Kirby and Stan Lee brought out a character named the Black Panther after the Black Panther Party had started, but before it had really started making a lot of headlines. And for a while, in the Black Panther was African. He was not African American. His secret identity was T'Challa, and he was from the kingdom of Wakanda. So their one black character was not an African American, and they started to backpedal a little bit, and he became known as Black Leopard for a time, and just the Panther, because they didn't want the associations of the Black Panthers. Finally, the East Village Other, an underground publication from New York, wrote an essay about the sort of hapless case of black characters in comic books, and Marvel kind of scrambled to start creating African American characters. They'd had a few, but you know, they were characters with names like Man Ape was one of them. That was a villain, and then they would have, there was like a blind Vietnam vet named Willie Lincoln. You know, they were definitely exactly the kind of slightly misinformed caricatures that you'd expect from a group of clueless white guys in New York. In 1972, Marvel started aiming a few titles at female audiences, and they got wives of some writers and artists to write these, but the women who wrote these were sort of saddled with the concepts and the names. So you had Shanna the She-Devil, and the Claws of the Cat, and Night Nurse, and so obviously this is you know, middle-aged men's idea of what, you know, what women would want to read about. You know, super heroines, and then there was Luke Cage, Power Man, which was kind of a Shaft ripoff, and this was a guy with an unbuttoned shirt and a chain belt and a tiara, and you know, he actually became popular and stuck around for a while, but yeah, Marvel made some missteps on the way to enlightenment, I guess.
Did you, when you were interviewing people for your book, did you ask them about this Jack Kirby litigation that has been going on for the last few years, and how they lost, and how anyone with a good idea today would be wise not to just give their ideas away and get screwed?
Yeah, Jack.
Could you repeat the question?
Yeah, the question is: did I speak to people about Jack Kirby, Jack Kirby's lawsuit against Marvel, which was brought forth shortly after Disney purchased Marvel, I believe, and. That's a big topic for comics creators now, and it has been for a long time. But of course, you know, it's unavoidable at this point. One of the most interesting things that I found in doing research for this book was that Stan Lee had actually started to make some noise about the treatment of comics creators way back 40 years ago. He privately spoke to a friend about wanting to leave comics altogether, and he wanted to take Jack Kirby to Hollywood with him, and he wanted to partner with Jack Kirby to make movies, because he said he didn't have a piece of anything, and he was tired of, you know, making money for a company that he didn't feel loyalty to anymore. You know, Marvel Comics had changed hands, and he felt like he didn't get a big enough piece of it. And so in 1971, there was a group of artists that got together for a cartoonist convention, and Stan Lee started railing against the idea of this industry. And he said, if somebody came to me and asked for advice on getting into the comic industry, I would tell them to keep your ideas, because you're not going to get any of it. Why would you want to work in an industry like this? For someone to come into comics now is pathetic. This is something that Stan Lee definitely didn't keep echoing in the subsequent decades as he continued to be the face of Marvel Comics. But at the time, he was really considering leaving for good. He took a sabbatical and started working on a screenplay for a little while. And when he did come back, he came back as president and publisher of Marvel Comics, and then started working on how to get comic books translated, to Hollywood movies, because he saw that as the escape hatch from the comic industry.
So what does young talent, what do they do today? People be scared to go into the business. There has to be some protection, otherwise the comic book industry would be dead,
Right, right. Well, I think people are just a little more clear-eyed about it. I think, they understand that this is work for hire, and if this is what, if they want just sort of the security of a paycheck, then that's an option. And if they want to take a chance and try to strike out on their own, there are a lot more options for people who want to do that than existed in the 60s, 70s, or 80s. So I think the trouble is that those lines were a lot more ambiguous before the lawsuits really started happening in the 1980s. In the 70s, a Marvel artist would get a paycheck and there would be a contract stamped on the back. So if you wanted to cash your check, you had to sign something that waived your claim on these creations, which is a very dodgy legal maneuver. And so I think things are a little bit less, a little less like the sort of the chess records sign the contract on the hood of the car thing. But
10 or 15 years ago, McFarlane created Spawn. It became successful. He made lots of money. Later on, I heard he bought the McGuire baseball for $110,000. So he's doing pretty good.
Yeah, Todd McFarlane was one of the guys who started Image Comics, and along with Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld and a few other popular Marvel artists. And those guys definitely acted in self-interest, and they the gamble paid off well for them. But it was a courageous thing to do, nonetheless. And I think that actually had a big impact on the economic landscape, of comic books in ways that are also negative, simply because Image Comics went on to do some things that hurt the retail community. That's a complicated legacy. But yeah, I find that it's very apropos that Todd McFarlane bought the Mark McGuire baseball, because there was something about those days of making a lot of money, and there's something about the characters with big guns and big muscles that really lines up with the steroid era of baseball for me.
Sean Howe, the author of Marvel Comics: The Untold Story. Howe spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on October 17th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Sean Howe in a moment, just about 9:46 now, KUOW 94.9. Daylight time ends this Sunday, November 3rd, at 2 a.m. Ever wonder why we got daylight saving time in the first place? One writer on the subject says the retail industry lobbied for it and farmers against it. We'll talk with him. Michael Downing, creative writing teacher at Tufts University and author of Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time. That'll be in the 1 o'clock hour tomorrow afternoon. Forecast says lows in the 40s tonight, mostly cloudy, chance of showers. Friday highs mid to upper 50s, mostly cloudy, chance of rain. Eclectic ukulele virtuoso Jake Shimabukuro is Michael Feinstein's guest this week on Song Travels. Among the tunes he plays are Somewhere Over the Rainbow and Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah in a duet with Michael. Song Travels beginning in a few minutes at 10 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from Dignity Memorial, hosting events in Everett and Seattle Tuesday, November 5th, featuring author on end-of-life care for veterans, Deborah Grassman. More information at dignitymemorialseattle.com.
It's election season, and your ballot needs to be returned by November 5th. The Seattle mayor's race is heating up. Plus, there are initiatives about genetically modified food labeling, a $15 an hour minimum wage, and public campaign financing, just to name a few of the contests. If you're not sure how to vote, you can see KUOW's election stories at KUOW.org. And join us every day to hear KUOW's comprehensive election coverage.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Sean Howe is a former editor of Entertainment Weekly and the Criterion Collection. His new book is called Marvel Comics, The Untold Story. Howe spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on October 17th, 2012. Next, he continues to take questions from the audience. The next question is, how did you go about your research for the book?
The research was an intensive three-year process. Unless you count the preceding 30 years of reading comic books and reading fanzines about comic books, I don't know that I could have possibly started cold 3 years ago and have come up with this book. But a lot of the history of the comics industry has been scattered through the world of fanzines and these low print run mimeographs that are just sort of crumbling in people's garages, if they exist at all. And so one of the things that I wanted to do was gather some of that history that hadn't made it to the New York Times, hadn't made it to the mainstream media. Nobody from Network News was interviewing these giants who created the characters that are now worth billions. And I do wish that someone had written this book 30 years ago, because there was a lot more living history. I would have loved to have interviewed some of the people who aren't around anymore. But it seems like there's always new archival stuff turning up, so hopefully that'll all be added to the story.
So, is there such a thing as online comics starting now? Is there a scene of some size?
There are a lot of online comics now. I don't follow it very closely myself. Marvel Comics they are making a lot of efforts to succeed in the digital world. I think one of the primary incentives for them is it's hard to get comics to kids now. If you go to a mom and pop store, well, you're not going to find a mom and pop store. But if you go to a chain drugstore, there's a good chance that you're going to see zero comic books there. There are comic book stores, but kids don't necessarily wander into those unless they're already indoctrinated, you know. So the comic book industry is really struggling to bring in new readers. The median age of a Marvel Comics reader right now is a little bit higher than 30.
Of those people that you would have liked to have interviewed, who would you think would have been the best storyteller if they weren't around anymore?
Of the people who are no longer around, the best storyteller in terms of knowing where the bodies are buried would probably be, you know, someone like, there's a guy named John Verporten who was, you know, a production manager at Marvel for 10 years. There are guys who just worked in the Marvel offices, you know, and sort of made corrections and did paste-ups and, you know, we're doing not very glamorous work, but who were there from the 40s through the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, and would have been able to tell amazing stories, you know, probably did. If you knew them in their lives, I'm sure that they had some great, you know, barroom gossip. Unfortunately, partially because they were not, you know, doing the glamorous work, they weren't interviewed at all. Martin Goodman, who founded the company, was quoted in a few articles, but you know, he died in 1994 and left behind no full-length interview, and that would have perhaps been, you know, the real golden egg.
Do you think comic books are going to go the way of the newspapers, because that's just the way society is moving towards? Because it looks like the comic book characters are being made into movies, and then the comic books are just kind of a marketing thing, where it should be the other way around.
I'm not sure if comics are going to become obsolete. I don't think it'll happen anytime soon. But I think that that's something, and something I've thought a lot about, is the idea that for most of America, Marvel Comics can be reduced to, you know, these trademarked characters, and that does a real disservice to the art form. I think the movies are as good as you can expect them to be, but when people think, oh, I've seen the Iron Man movie, so I now understand why people liked, Marvel Comics. I think that that's not true. I think that there's a lot that's just beautiful about, you know, the layout of a page and just the way that the comic form can tell stories in a different way from other media. And so hopefully some of that mojo will rub off from the Hollywood success. Because for me, you know, a lot of what I love about comic books is actually comic books. You know, people have been asking me a lot who my favorite character is, and I've realized that it's not, you know, as great as some of these characters are. They're sort of like, you know, blank canvases for individual writers and artists to project upon. And so I have favorite interpretations of characters, and I more so than you know, I like to read everything with Amazing Spider-Man, you know, in it. It's instead you know, I like Frank Miller's Daredevil is what does it for me, and I like to see what those creators can do with, you know, the clay of the characters. Yeah.
Do you have any theory or speculation about why at this point in time studios have been adapting all of the comic books instead of the more popular comic book heroes instead of, say, 10 years ago or 20 years ago? They were making, you know, more intelligent, dramatic films. Do you think they've just kind of run out of ideas, or what is it that this transition has gained so much cachet?
It was about 15 years ago that Marvel characters started successfully coming to the big screen, and that actually started with the character of Blade, which was the Wesley Snipes movie, which was never a real marquee character, but that kind of, you know, opened doors, I guess, as well as Spider-Man had the rights to Spider-Man had been contested for many, 2 decades pretty much before that was made. And I think the reasons that things started to work out were really just, it was a lot of luck, I think. Things get lost in development for a long time in Hollywood, and once somebody makes a lot of money with a certain kind of concept, everything else that's in development gets rushed into it. And so, you know, there was Blade, and then there was the X-Men movie in 2000, and the Spider-Man movie in 2002, and then it was, you know, they were kind of home free. I think also technology has helped. I think CGI has made it a lot easier to make a superhero movie that doesn't seem embarrassingly campy. Although they still manage to sometimes do that.
Okay.
Thank you guys very much.
Sean Howe, the author of Marvel Comics, The Untold Story. Howe spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on October 17th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Sounders FC, who advanced in the MLS Cup playoffs to the Western Conference semifinals. Saturday evening, the Sounders faced the Portland Timbers in the first leg of the semifinals at CenturyLink Field at 7 p.m. More information at soundersfc.com. Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, offering service to more than 130 destinations across the globe. More at emirates.com/US. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow. 959 KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. To the best of our knowledge, this week is on the theme Building Stories. Cartoonist Chris Ware has a graphic novel called Building Stories. We'll hear him talk about it. Kevin Miyazaki is a fine arts photographer. His father's family was interned during World War II. But that was rarely discussed when Kevin was growing up. One day, however, Kevin's family history merged with his art. We will hear about that and a conversation about J.G. Ballard's futuristic 1975 novel High Rise, wherein class warfare erupts among residents of a high-rise apartment building. To the best of our knowledge, tomorrow evening at 9. Forecast says lows in the 40s tonight, mostly cloudy, chance of showers. Friday highs mid to upper 50s. Mostly cloudy, chance of rain. KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington, thanks to the wisdom and generosity of contributing listeners.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.